For almost 2,000 years, the Catholic Church has pointed the way toward salvation through Jesus Christ. For each of us, that journey starts in darkness, as if in a cave. We invite you now to come with us as we seek wisdom and truth by way of faith and reason with your guides, Mark Tuttle and Timothy O'Donnell. Join us in the Catholic Cave. Welcome once again to the Catholic Cave. I'm Kent Blanford. In the cave with me, Mr. Mark Tuttle, Mr. Timothy O'Donnell. Gentlemen, Fortnight for Freedom is upon us. Now, one of the things that's emphasized during the Fortnight for Freedom is the emphasis on conscience. Do we, as a people, do we as individuals have a well-developed, and how do we get a well-developed conscience?
Well-developed conscience, that's a big...
good qualifier.
Yeah, I was going to say, that kind of expands the whole conversation there.
And we only have an hour.
Because I think that's where a lot of people make the mistake with conscience, is they kind of insist that, well, I have freedom of conscience, which means I can do anything. Right. You know, I'm free to do whatever the heck I want. And freedom of conscience really, I think, pertains more to a freedom and an older understanding of the word freedom that is based on an idea of a well-formed conscience. You don't have a free conscience unless you have one that's well-formed. So we got a lot to unpack with that, because we got to go back and kind of talk about what different views of freedom we have in this country and how that applies to our conscience.
Yeah, and maybe the first thing I'll do is I've pulled out, Mark, our trusty copy of the Catechism of the Catholic Church.
See, don't do that, because when you do that, you end all debate right there. You pull out the Catechism, and debate just stops, because there's the answer.
Well, it could...
Au contraire, that's your answer. Now, there
that's
are
true.
Others out there who may disagree.
They may conscientiously object.
What yes. I was going to do is simply define what conscience is. That way, when we discuss freedom or well-formed conscience, we'll kind of know what we're talking about. So, but feel free to disagree with the Catechism at your own peril. So the Catechism here, this is in paragraph 1776, just says this. Deep within his conscience, man discovers a law which he has not laid upon himself, but which he must obey. Its voice ever calling him to love and to do what is good and to avoid evil sounds in his heart at the right moment. For man has in his heart a law inscribed by God. His conscience is man's most secret core, is at his most secret core, and his sanctuary. There he is alone with God, whose voice echoes in his depths. So I think right there we can go right to Aquinas, right? Aquinas, I think, some when you read his treatise on the natural moral law, it's always summed up as, you know, kind of do good and avoid evil.
Right, right. And everybody has kind of a sense of the good is the idea. But, you know, sometimes that's hard to believe. You read the headlines, you read the news, you read about what evil lurks in the hearts of man.
Right.
And you do kind of question if everybody does have that voice deep down inside of them that, as the Catechism says, they must obey. That word must, I think, is an interesting one that's stuck in there.
Yes. Well, I think that that's going to point us to some of the things that we've talked about on previous shows, like the role of, we may get to like the role of education, things like that. So it's this, the document that Kent was talking about that we've liked to refer to this time of year, because we're in the Fortnight of Freedom, established by the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops.
Wait. Hold right there. Before we go too much further, this Fortnight for Freedom, what exactly is that? Because I think a lot of people may be unfamiliar with it. You know, I know a lot of parishes do talk about it, but a lot of parishes don't. So what is this Fortnight for Freedom that you speak of, Tim?
Well, Fortnight is 14 days, and it begins with the feasts of two great martyrs, Saints John Fisher and Saint Thomas More, who were martyred for adhering to their conscience in the face of terrible persecution, and then ultimately they were killed by King Henry VIII. And they took a stance that was in line with Holy Mother Church and the Holy Father at the time, which is that they refused to recognize King Henry VIII, who had proclaimed himself the new and sort of ordained himself the head of the Catholic Church in England. And to this day, the monarchy is still the head of the, although they call it the Church of England, the monarchy is still the head of the Church in England. And so that sparked, founding events of the Reformations that we've talked about on this show and other shows.
Right. And you know, St. Thomas More and St. John Fisher were not the only two martyrs there in Reformation England.
No.
You know, there were thousands that were martyred there in the course of all of that.
This just happens to line up with, I think, because the Fortnight for Freedom is particular to the United States. It's not a universal event or celebration or thing like that. It's particular to the United States, and it allows us to take those 2 weeks between the feast days, June 22nd, and the Independence Day, 4th of July, to really reflect on these really important themes and ideas and actions that we as Catholics should be, how we would approach what it means to be an American citizen.
Right, because freedom of conscience, when you look at it from that perspective, really has more to do with a freedom of religious belief and a freedom of religious expression that was one of the founding principles of the United States. So, you know, from the blood of these two martyrs spurned a movement, not just Catholics, but separatists and Puritans. There we go. but yeah, the Puritans and the separatists within England, they were persecuted as well, and so they found refuge here in the New World. And you know, that's really kind of the one of the founding principles of the United States is freedom of conscience when it comes to matters of religion.
Yeah, religion, of course, being supremely important, right, in people's lives. And in fact, those of us who are religious would say it's the most important part of our lives. And so we take this time to reflect on what it means to be both a good Catholic and a good American citizen at the same time. And this document that was that the bishops put together is really phenomenal. It's called Forming Consciences for Faithful Citizenship, a call to political responsibility from the Catholic bishops of the United States. And what precipitated Fortnight for Freedom and then this document and some of the other things that have been developed along the way really was going back to the previous administration, federal administration under President Obama, around conscious rights and protection as legislation was being built and implemented around the Affordable Care Act.
Right, because you had the infamous HHS mandate, which was going to tell Catholic schools, Catholic hospitals, convents, basically any Catholic institution that wasn't a parish, that they had to cover contraception in their insurance programs. And so, yeah, I mean, there was a long protracted court battle that went up to the Supreme Court at least once. I'm thinking it may have even gone up to the Supreme Court twice to try to clear that and try to reestablish that, no, you have the freedom to, I guess, live according to your religious beliefs, and you can't have a government edict that dictates to you against, really, honestly, the foundational core of your business. That you have to do something that violates your conscience.
Right. And that's been the question we've been wrestling with really since, well, it's getting close to 10 years now for us here in America. And there's been other more recent in the news. I know something, Kent, you've been following closely too, which is the we had the incident with the recent Supreme Court ruling of Masterpiece Cake Shop. And as well as We had another in which case the Supreme Court ruled really in favor that the owners of Masterpiece Ketchup couldn't be compelled to violate their conscience in order to produce a wedding cake for a same-sex marriage. I know that's something we've all been following. And I think also, though, again, recently in the news, something we were talking about a little bit before the show began was around this Sarah Huckabee Sanders incident, where, again, you have someone, you have an incident, catches national news, but it's an incident in which you have someone, again, operating a business who is refusing service to, you know, someone else. And their argument that they're standing on is one of conscience, that in good conscience, I can't serve you because of a particular view or disagreement that we have.
Right, right. And so, you know, I think most people, in both cases, quite honestly, I think a lot of people find the action of saying, no, I'm not going to serve you, or no, I'm not going to bake your cake for your wedding, as somewhat rude, immoral is probably too strong a word for it, but definitely something ethically questionable to look somebody square in the eye and say, no, you just need to leave now. A lot of people find that rude, but that is acting according to somebody's conscience. So the question that really raises, I think, for our discussion is, where's the limit? I mean, what can you stand on conscience and say, no, I conscientiously need to do this, even in the face of it being, you know, socially unacceptable or even outright rude?
I would say a lot of people see that. I think that that's a fair depiction. But I would also add, though, that the courts went so far as to say it is immoral because they prosecuted them. So they found it illegal in the case of Masterpiece Bake Shop. So and that's how it wound up in ultimately at the Supreme Court. Well, I think it goes back to, as we were talking about, Mark, with conscience. It's that edict to and requirement to love, do good, and avoid evil. Now it's figuring out which actions fall under those title, you know, those sort of buckets, if you will. That's the tricky part.
Right. And I would say where that tricky part comes from and where the discussion comes from and where the disagreements come from it aren't so much around definitions of conscience, which, as you said, paragraph 1776 in the Catechism. Which
oddly enough.
I don't think that's ironic. You know, I don't think that's an accident that it's paragraph 1776. But, the definition of conscience isn't the tricky part. The tricky Correct. Part is the definition of freedom. So we're going to have to take a quick break. And when we come back, let's talk a little bit about the meaning of freedom.
You're listening to The Catholic Cave on Catholic Radio Indy.
Radio is one of the biggest tools that God uses to get truth and hope and life.
To get the truths and the promises of God
into the ears and the hearts of people driving around.
Into the hearts of people through these airways.
Catholic Radio Indy.
Welcome back to The Catholic Cave. I'm Mark Tuttle here with Timothy O'Donnell and Kent Blanford, and we are talking about freedom of conscience. And right before the break, we kind of mentioned that I think the point that people disagree on when you talk about freedom of conscience and where these court cases come from aren't so much the bounds of conscience as they are an understanding of freedom and what freedom means. Because when you read the definition that Tim drug in from the Catholic Catechism.
Despite being advised not to.
Right. Paragraph 1776.
Easy to remember, right? Fortnite for freedom.
Right. And when you read that, you see that the conscience is defined as a propensity to do good and avoid evil. I think that's
it's the law.
A Thomistic summary there.
Yes.
Yeah, but... but
and it's God's voice. Yeah,
right.
God's
voice. And you know, St. Thomas Aquinas would say, you know, that's really the definition of freedom. You know, freedom is the propensity and ability to pursue good and avoid evil. The problem is that's not the modern conception of freedom at all. You know, I think when we talk about freedom in the modern context, we mean you're free to do whatever the heck you want. And whether it's good or evil, I'm free, so I can pursue whatever I want. And that's not really the understanding of freedom that when the bishops talk about freedom of conscience, they're using the word freedom to mean.
Yeah, it's a you're right. It's a kind of divorce, if you will. Freedom had previously always been understood to stand in an inseparable relation to responsibility. So freedom as this capacity to choose between alternatives A and B is a recognition of, say, free will. And then freedom would be the capacity then to then pursue it. But it was always understood when freedom was brought up, it was always understood that it was in relation to my responsibility to choose the good and avoid evil because I'm a moral agent. And as a moral agent, meaning that I can reflect before I take any action, I can think about it. I can deliberate and I can size up to a certain extent the moral worth of pursuing A versus pursuing B. And I'm required to use my freedom to act in such a way that's in accord with right reason, which is to choose the good or the better of the two alternatives.
Right. And so when we're talking about conscience, I think that's hugely important that when we're talking about freedom of conscience, we're talking about freedom in that sense, because it makes no sense to talk about. And I think this is where people get goofed up a little bit when they talk about freedom of conscience. It makes no sense to talk about conscience giving you the capacity to do whatever the heck you want.
Correct.
Because conscience is guiding you. It's
It's a practical judgment.
Jiminy Cricket from the Pinocchio movie.
Yes.
Always let your conscience be your guide.
Right.
You know, for the conscience to be your guide, it's got to be an understanding of freedom in that sense. That this is a capacity to pursue the good and avoid the evil.
There's got to be a sense of. There's a kind of a moral analysis that comes with conscience to say that and that's the voice of God, we would say, through the definition of the catechism, is that there's this law that's outside of ourselves that's pointing that we can evaluate or assess the moral worth or moral character of words, deeds, actions.
Right. Now that leads to another huge question that I think a lot of people have, especially these days when it comes to freedom of conscience, which is, okay, if we're all endowed with a conscience and we all have this capacity to know the good and to avoid the evil, then why the heck do I need a church? Why do I need a catechism? Why do I need anybody telling me what's right and wrong if I know it innately to begin with?
Right. And then the argument to extend that also would be, and we should organize our communities and political arrangements such that I maximize my choosing.
Right. And not just my choosing, but sort of the collective choosing that comes out of a democracy.
Correct.
Right?
Correct. Yeah. That's the trajectory we're on. Right. And that's the common understanding. And I would say the difference would be, I would use, if I were to retrieve older words to describe the current setting, I would say, the contemporary understanding of freedom is more like the word we used to use, license. I have a license to do whatever I want. And then I would also say that...
Ooh, that's good, because you know what comes to mind is James Bond with the
license
to
kill.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, but I mean, that's an example of when you're talking about license, you're usually not talking about a license to do good.
Right. That's right. And then I would also say, again, freedom has traditionally been understood to be in an inseparable relation with responsibility. I would say when we use the term liberty, we do tend to think, I think we do tend to conceive liberty as being different from freedom. And liberty still today, to me, seems for most of us, still have that connection with the good, pursuing what's good. And so I would say we're in a setting of license where people feel that the common understanding is I want the license to do whatever I want. And what I want to do is you know, I don't want to ascribe bad motives to people, but conscience is a delicate thing. And a conscience needs to, as the document is called, it needs to be formed and informed. In other words, we're not born with a complete and instinctive, completely self-sufficient conscience. It rather, through our family life, through education, and primarily, and ultimately, as we grow into adulthood and through adulthood, It's the teachings of Holy Mother Church that serve as the most reliable, steadfast guide to forming our conscience so that we know when we might be mistaken or not.
Right.
Because that's not the real possibility.
Exactly. It's not an easy process
to have
a well-formed conscience.
No.
I mean, we live in a world that's fallen. We're all fallen individuals to begin with. And I think that's to a certain extent, that's the reason we have conscience. That would be a little bit of an anthropological debate that might ensue out of all of this, is how much is conscience the result of original sin? In other words, if we were still Adam and Eve, would we really need a conscience? Or is this something that's the result of having fallen, that we have to have something like a conscience?
That's an interesting question. My quick answer to that would be, because Adam and Eve were born in freedom, they had
a conscience, but they had nothing.
Because they would have to know right from wrong.
But they had nothing that led them to have a malformed conscience.
Correct.
And so it's...
Although one might say the serpent acted as a kind of moral evil in persuading Eve. It didn't act in complete isolation, right? She was tempted,
right,
and gave in to the temptations. And that's a great, that's a great point for our current world. There's all kinds of things
that's
in the wrong direction.
That's why I brought it up, because I think when we look at a document like what the bishops issued on this, and we see conscience in a very pure, pristine type of you have to have a well-formed conscience, and it makes it sound so easy.
Yeah, it sounds academic and theoretical,
right? But we live in a fallen world where we're bombarded daily with I think things that malform our conscience and lead us away from the good and are really trying to draw us to pursue evil.
Now, guys, I'm going to disagree with you on the Adam and Eve situation, because if you look, what they ate from was the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. If you have no knowledge of good and evil, is a conscience necessary?
Right. Mm. And did they have, did they have a knowledge of good and evil before they ate from the fruit?
God did give them, now it may not be an internal voice like our conscience is, but God did give them a command, an external command, not to eat from that tree. So maybe in that sense it functions, that command. Functions are kind of, I don't know. Yeah. I'm going to have to give that more thought, actually.
Yeah, so, I mean, we...
That's interesting. I think
going back...
It's kind of like, without that original sin, was Christ necessary for our salvation?
Right.
It's that kind of theoretical.
I think I've sidetracked you guys.
No, not at all.
This may well be a call for Catholic answers.
That's right.
We'll have to pick up the phone later.
Jimmy Akin.
I'll tell you what, though. I think going back and meditating on... on the first few chapters of Genesis, including the fall, is something that every Catholic should do annually. Go back, read it, meditate on it, contemplate it, think about it, because really, honestly, that is kind of the beginning of the understanding of a Catholic anthropology.
Absolutely.
John Paul II's Theology of the Body, that's a 200 to 300 page meditation on the first 2 to 3, chapters of Genesis. So,
yeah. And everything hinges on, so much hinges on having a correct understanding of anthropology, of what it means to be a human
And I
person.
Think where we, I think our... Really, our contemporary world setting, where we fall down anthropologically, in other words, our understanding of who man is and what makes us human, what really sets us apart from the other animals, I think where we fall down is we've lost an understanding of sin and the effects of sin and how sin has really changed human nature. And so going back and thinking about the fall, what it meant, what we were like before the fall and what the consequences of that, that's a perfect setup for talking about something like conscience and freedom of conscience and
the
subjects we're talking about today.
I agree. And I was thinking, though, too, about something you said earlier, Mark, and I may maybe step forward out of the morass of fallen human nature.
Have I led us into a morass, Tim?
I just always wanted to say it on the air. I've been waiting 2 years to use it. is
came, this, up on his, came up on his word for the day.
Yeah, just don't ask me how to spell it. So what can we do? What would be a practical way for us to think about forming conscience so that we can begin to sort out, you know, good from evil? And I would say the very first moral code that is of tremendous service and value to us is the Ten Commandments.
Yeah.
So once we know what that we should memorize what they are, but then also study which each of them and how you work, because each one of them need to be kind of worked out in the contemporary setting as well. But that's the beginning moral code that can guide us into loving our neighbors as ourselves, doing good and avoiding evil.
Right. And once again, it's one of those things that seems deceptively easy. You know, the Ten Codes, okay, thou shalt not kill. I haven't killed anybody. That one's pretty easy. Adultery, okay, maybe a little harder, but for the most part, that one's pretty easy to follow too. but, you know, they seem easy to follow, but when you start to unpack them, and especially, and I think, I guess we're not quite coming up on a break here. So we can unpack them a little bit, but you have to go backwards. You have to start with Commandment 10, and move towards and build on Commandment 10 to get to Commandment 1. That was a trick somebody recently taught me.
Oh, and I don't know that one. We'll have to go through that.
Thinking through it, it makes a lot of sense.
And we'll pick up at...
We are ready for a break.
We are at a break, so we're going to pick up with Commandment number 10 right after this. You're listening to The Catholic Cave on Catholic Radio Indy.
One day, one voice shared one message, and one man who provides one way to God. Maybe that's why we have one objective. Share Jesus, the one who loves, saves, and forgives. Catholic Radio Indy.
And welcome back to The Catholic Cave. We are talking today about conscience. And actually, we started talking about conscience. I've kind of drug us off into a morass, to use that word again. So right before the break, we were getting ready to talk about the Ten Commandments. And I learned this trick from the late René Girard. So, the French philosopher.
Yes.
That when you're looking at the Ten Commandments, one of the better ways to look at them, I guess there's lots of ways you can look at the Ten Commandments, but according to René Girard, one of the better ways is to look at them backwards. So you start with that 10th commandment of thou shalt not covet. Because coveting, ultimately, when you think about it, that is kind of the original sin. You know, what the serpent tempted Eve with was to what? Be like God.
Yes.
You know, and when you start to think about that, that's also what Christ calls us to. Christ calls us to a life through him that allows us to be like God. But that temptation is to imitate God in a way that we set ourselves up as rivals with God, that we envy God, that we covet the power and things that God has. Yes. So that's the fallen state of man. So to restore ourselves, we have to move through the Ten Commandments. And the first is to really examine our consciences and look at all of the different ways that we covet and all of the different ways that we envy and try to, instead of allowing ourselves to seek to be equal with God in a way that's, as Paul would say, that we're grasping, to empty ourselves and to make ourselves like a slave. And then the other commandments then begin to fall into place. And ultimately, we lead from a human perfection. So you've got all of the kind of human side of the Ten Commandments to a repairing our relationship with God, with the first three. Exactly.
Yes.
So you read them backwards if you want a good, thorough examination of conscience.
I'm going to have to go back and do that because that does sound really fascinating. Especially having read some René Girard, but so much of, right, I think of the, what, you know, sort of is a toxin in our culture and just in our personal relationship is that covetousness and that that kind of rivalry, you know, that a rivalry that sort of causes one to want to aggressively assert oneself over and against one's neighbor.
Right. And, you know, ultimately what it does is it leads you to lose sight of who you are. It leads you to lose your own identity in this sort of attempt to keep up with the Joneses.
It's dehumanizing at some point, at some level.
Exactly. And you know, I think that's, you know, to try to bring us out of the morass here.
Let's go over to the swamp next.
I think that's crucial for forming your conscience and for following your conscience, is having that sense of really who God's created you to be. Because, you know, I think that's the other side of conscience that gets a little bit dicey, that's not quite so nice and neat, is we're each called to something slightly different. We each all have kind of a unique calling. Yeah, there's a universal Christian call to holiness, but how we live that holiness out is idiosyncratic. We each do it in our own way, through our own lives, through our own circumstances within our lives. And so following our conscience in that way, in some ways we're cast out into the deep to figure it out for ourselves. And that trying to keep a sense of who you are by not falling into the whole, I think, world of illusion and world of rivalry and desire and everything.
Self-deception.
Everything that the world is, trying to pull yourself out of that to get a good sense of who you are so that you can follow your conscience actively. You know, that's a lot of what the bishops are calling us to.
Well, I think there's a lot of merit in what you're saying. And the way forward is it's exercising right reason. So, right. But then again, going back to, it's availing ourselves of the teachings of Holy Mother Church are the ways in which we can inform our conscience. It also serves us too, since conscience at the end of the day is God's voice speaking within, we have to be mindful of and be intentional about putting ourselves in situations more broadly, leading lives that draw us closer and put us in the presence of God. So things like that are important are things like receiving the sacraments worthily, right? Attending Mass, living a life of virtue, right? Both the cardinal virtues and the theological virtues.
Right, because a lot of times forming your conscience isn't a matter of addition. It's a matter of subtraction. You know, as we've said, you know, we all have this innate knowledge of good and evil to a certain extent. Once again, whether that's a result of the fall or whether that's pre-fall, that's that might be a question for Catholic answers. but nonetheless, we all have this innate knowledge of good and evil. And a lot of times it's getting rid of the muck and the mire and things that obscure that leads us to knowledge of the right way to act versus the wrong way to act, rather than sitting down and studying ethics or studying the proper actions. It's not a matter of adding knowledge. It's a matter of kind of clearing the groundwork so that we can actually see what's always been there to begin with.
Yeah, and I think that's where those, again, that you look at the Ten Commandments and the Ten Commandments are ideal at clearing away the muck, as you put it. It's also though important to understand that there are real consequences to living a life of sin, and especially if one were to habituate oneself to the life of sin or a life of evil or a life of vice, because in many ways that will deform your conscience. And often at times it's been described as, you know, sort of silencing or even killing your conscience. In other words, right, by continuing to do what you know is wrong, eventually you will quiet and muffle out, you know, the voice that keeps telling you, don't do it, it's wrong, and you keep doing it anyway. Eventually you can convince yourself, you can habituate yourself in such a way that you make it convince yourself it's right.
Right, right. And you know, we were talking about kind of the I think the misunderstandings that come about because we really have dueling conceptions of freedom these days. You know, we have a modern conception of freedom, which is, as you said, license.
To do what I want.
License to do what I want versus freedom, which is exercising really your moral muscle so that you can do what you ought to do.
Correct.
So
I love that. Yeah, the word ought.
Yeah. So
do what we ought to do.
I think part of that, as you pointed out, Tim, is there's a responsibility that we have with freedom. So the opposite of freedom, maybe not opposite, maybe the flip side of the coin, is the responsibility to act well. And the consequences for when we don't go beyond just ourselves. And I think that's where I think bringing this back to the bishop's document, that freedom of conscience, that freedom to act according to our conscience, it affects more than just us. Because if we neglect that and we start to act against our conscience, it brings everybody else down. It affects all of those people around us in a way that really negates not just individual freedom we've been talking about, but ultimately political freedom as well.
Yeah, the common good.
Yeah, exactly. So. Yeah, if you can't pursue the good and you can't move towards the common good, nobody else can either. Or at least you inhibit other people's ability to.
Right. And that's why unjust laws like legalized abortion have a tremendously ill effect, not just on the direct killing of unborn children, but it has a terrible, it creates a terrible sear, I would say, in the conscience of our culture, because it's legal. We have given legal status to a grave moral evil.
Yeah, and it's an unpleasant topic to think about, but thinking about abortion and where it came from. So, 1973, we have Roe versus Wade. That didn't come out of a vacuum.
Correct.
There were a series of individual choices made by individual Americans for probably 50 years prior to 1973 that all added up. And they all created a tidal wave of pressure that eventually the court felt. And I'm not exonerating the court. What they did was obviously evil and wrong, and they should have had better formed consciences than to, as they say, manufacture a right to abortion. I mean, that's just wrong on so many fronts.
Right.
But the pressure that was put by individual societal choices of people having wrongly formed consciences.
Correct.
Or neglecting to follow their rightly formed consciences, that pressure eventually led to the legalization of abortion. So it's not just, the action of one or two people. I mean, this was sort of a collective push of, I think, that gradual stream of conscience being lost.
I agree. And I also think that's what sustains it. Right. There's not enough. There's not enough of us who are against abortion and have a proper understanding of the sanctity of human life to have enough political power at this point to overturn that.
Yeah. It's a powerful concept. And it's something that was really brought to my attention by, another brilliant French philosopher, this time Jacques Maritain, though.
Oh, yeah.
And he talks about a dialectic. Don't get excited. He's not talking about a Hegelian dialectic.
Oh,
he's pretty clear. This
there's
is not,
Hegel.
This
there's is not, two more
no,
coming.
No.
Kant and Heidegger.
Right. No.
They always, the unholy trio.
Right. Exactly. We're talking about conscience. So we're talking about brilliant French philosophers, not German philosophers.
Right. I am a big Maritain fan. So.
But anyway, yeah, the dialectic he talks about are you on the one hand you have the kind of the course of historical events. As those march forward. And those they're somewhat in our control, but to a great extent, they're kind of out of our control. But those interact with our individual choices. Those interact with our freedom and the choices that we make almost on a day-to-day basis. And that dialectic, that back and forth between them moves history forward. And it moves moral progress. Or if we neglect our conscience and don't follow our conscience, it can lead to moral regress.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. Because all of us, right? I mean, this is the importance again of one of the results of having formed or poorly one's conscience is it leads to actions, right? Words, deeds, and actions. And then all of us, right, on a day-to-day basis, taking a full account the laws of the land in which we live. And if we live like in America, it's a generally a law-abiding country. We're going to make our choices that generally align with the laws that are on the books. Right. Right?
So this is all very abstract. I mean, you know, the bishop's document is very abstract. Our whole conversation about conscience is very abstract. So what does this mean? What are we being called to here on a maybe not day-to-day basis, but I think just sort of our average everyday lives? How does our conscience really interact with the way we ought to be living our lives?
And that's the question we'll have to answer right after this break. We'll be back with more of the Catholic Cave right after this.
An interview with Father Trenton Rauch and his story on how Catholic radio influenced his vocation.
I was not struck by lightning and knocked off my horse. I had a lot of time driving in the car listening to the radio, and I just gotten to a point where I would prefer to listen to something that would be intellectually stimulating. And at the same time, I was learning about the faith, particularly the apologetics.
Catholic Radio, building faith, building vocations.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. I'm Timothy O'Donnell in the cave with Mark Tuttle as usual and Kent Blanford. And we've been talking about conscience within the context of the Fortnight for Freedom here, leading up to Independence Day and beginning with the feast days of the Holy Martyrs, Saints John Fisher and Saint Thomas More. And Mark, we have been talking at a fairly theoretical or academic level. So
that's kind of an understatement.
So yes, let's so what do we want to do with
who have we not talked about? I mean, we've talked about Maritain, we've talked about Girard. No, this hasn't been abstract at all.
St. John Paul II. Yeah. So for our listeners, let's talk about maybe now. So there's always theory and practice. So we've talked a lot about kind of quote-unquote the theoreticals here. Let's talk a little bit about practical application. What are some of the implications of these principles and theories that we've been talking about?
Well, I think the church does a good summary, and I would grab your catechism that's sitting there across and start flipping through it for all the different parts of this. But I think it boils down to the social justice teachings of the church.
Yes.
And not the misunderstanding of social justice. I think that's another we could do a whole show on that of the misuse of the term social justice.
Correct.
But nonetheless, and I think it starts with when you have a well-formed conscience, it leads to empathy for others. And that empathy leads to, I think, probably, once again, you have to take some of these principles in backwards order of the way they're presented. Mm. So solidarity is often one of the principles of social justice of the church that's presented last, but it's one of the ones that you got to start with first, I think. And so having that empathy and being able to stand shoulder to shoulder with those who are oppressed, looking around for the oppressed in society and trying to stand shoulder to shoulder with them and trying to stand in solidarity with them. I think that's kind of the first concrete step that you take when you have a well-formed conscience.
Well, and with that, it's a call to action, right, is what you're pointing us towards. And yes, the church has a rich history of different social teachings that are easy to for us to access these days, especially with the internet. And it touches on, it's interesting, it touches on...
We don't have to flip page by page through the catechism to get it?
We could. We could. I have it, I have the online version and the hard copy.
Oh.
We also have, though, in this document by the bishop, just to give you some ideas about, you know, a little bit about where we might be active. I mean, there's so many things that pertain to life issues, sanctity of life. We talked about healthcare issues, and especially think about not just abortion, but of course euthanasia, right?
Right.
And that's another area in which a well-formed conscience, especially informed by the teaching of the Holy Catholic Church, really can make a huge difference,
right? Because,
in that debate.
Because once again, what is that asking us to do? It's asking us to stand in solidarity
with the vulnerable,
with the most defenseless and most vulnerable among us, those who have absolutely no way to defend themselves. One of the first steps that we can take when we have a well-formed conscience is to make sure that we as a society are protecting them.
Yeah, and it's also going to pertain to, you know, other hot button issues like what? Immigration.
Exactly. Right? We have to make sure that immigrants are being treated as human beings, that they're not, we're not treating them in a way that, violates their dignity as humans.
Right. And we've, you know, there's a, the list is long. The one other one though I thought I would mention too is really promoting education, right? And that you know, education through whether it's homeschooling or public schools or parochial schools or other private schools or enterprises is a, you know, primary way that we are forming the next generation, right? And so being very active in what our schools teach and who's teaching them and what they're teaching them makes all the difference.
Right, right. And I would say also...
And I know you're very passionate about that.
Yeah, 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 education. But then I would say, you know, the next thing is having a concern and care particularly for the poor. Particularly for those who are having a hard time finding their way in current society, those who need a little bit of extra help, going out of our way to kind of, as the church puts it, give them a preferential treatment. You know, give them the little bit of extra help that they need.
All right. I also wanted to, before we run out of time, I wanted to kind of bring us around to something we've been discussing a little bit or touched on a little bit, which is, you know, where, Mark, where would you draw a boundary when it comes to one following one's conscience in the public square?
Right, because that's kind of the, I think, the biggest question that's there today. I mean, you've got these.
That's the masterpiece cake shop.
Exactly. That's Sarah Sanders being kicked out of a restaurant for, I mean, not even for her political beliefs. I mean, basically for the job that she has.
Right.
You know, she was kicked out of this restaurant. So where's the line there? I mean, on the one hand, the people that refused service in both of these cases, they claimed they were following a well-formed conscience. On the other hand, a lot of people disagree, both sides. Yeah, they look at this and kind of say, no, you're not acting in a way that's going to lead us towards a common good. You're acting against that. And what you did was wrong. So I think having that foundation of an idea of a common good, and I think therefore having a climate where we can have a discussion about where society's headed, where we need to head, being able to keep those pathways open for dialogue is part of the common good. So things that go against that, I think, are not upholding conscience, but probably are violating somebody's conscience.
So where, to put you on the spot,
yeah,
where would you, with the restaurateur and Sarah Huckabee, where would you draw the line?
Well, I would say that as a business owner, you do have a certain duty to treat your customers fairly and equally. No matter who they are, no matter what their political beliefs are, etc. You know, having a conversation about where you disagree politically afterwards, or, you know, even during dinner, that's all called for. You know, writing letters to people, hey, you were at my restaurant, blah, 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 blah. I just wanted to say, blah, 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 blah. That's all called for. But when you start to discriminate against people based on their political beliefs, you know, I think you are kind of crossing a line between what your obligation is, what responsibility you have as a business owner. And that is to treat your customers with a certain amount of dignity and fairness, not kicking them out of your restaurant because you disagree with them politically. Now, on the flip side, you've got the Masterpiece Cake Shop, which the Supreme Court just came and said, no, they have a right to not create a wedding cake. But I think it's a slightly different situation, because what you're doing is you're asking that shop owner to participate in something that they disagree with. So, you know,
namely the wedding ceremony.
The wedding ceremony, right? The red hen. You know, that business was not asked to participate in the policies of Donald Trump by serving Sarah Sanders her breakfast or lunch or dinner or whatever she went there for. They weren't being asked to participate. The owner of Masterpiece Cake was being asked to participate in a wedding that he conscientiously disagreed with. So there's a difference there between whether you're being asked to participate in something or whether you are just being asked to conduct business with somebody that you may disagree with.
Yeah, and I think of the master. I think that's a good job. That's a really good market delineating some of those differences. I think the other one too, maybe worth mentioning quickly, is with the Masterpiece Cake Shop. There was a, because the cake was special ordered, there's a kind of artistry that would go into making the cake.
Oh, don't tell a cook that, though. There's no artistry in the food that they put together for their customers at a restaurant.
Well, I would say, though, that I wouldn't say that there isn't any, but there's something different from what. So even at the bake shop, there was all kinds of pre-made goods. Of course, take some artistry to make, but they're more standard fare that he was selling to anyone who came in for any reason that they wanted. It what elevated the issue with Masterpiece is the purpose for which the cake was being used, and the additional artistry, the sort of pouring himself into it in a way much more so than just following the standard recipe to bake cupcakes, let's say.
Right. Well,
it's just another factor that's in there.
I think another big factor that we as Catholics have to keep in mind is the Masterpiece Cake thing came about because of an original injustice that was there in legalizing and sanctioning same-sex marriage, elevating same-sex relationships to the same status as heterosexual relationships. That in itself kind of disrupts the moral order enough to where you're going to have issues that come up downstream.
Right. Well, I would say one other thing too, that as it pertains to this issue of, you know, standing on conscience, as I understand, you know, sort of precedents and laws, that, you know, we ought to, and as Americans ought to, create a wide sphere for which people of goodwill to follow their conscience, because to follow one's conscience, even if it's malformed, means that the person is attempting to do what they believe to be right and good, even if they're ultimately proven to be wrong or mistaken.
Right. And, you know, there's a practical principle in there. And St. Thomas Aquinas talks about that, is we don't want to live in a society or a state where every single moral virtue and every single moral attitude is enforced by the force of law.
Yeah, everything's already been dictated.
Exactly. You know, you have to leave, to a certain extent, you have to leave people a certain amount of freedom to be able to err, to be able to make mistakes, to be able to be human. I hate that phrase, by the way, be human. But because it's always looking at the wrong side of what it means to be human. But
yeah, to err. Well, I think that brings up, one with a few minutes left here. This idea of being able to have sort of a civil discourse without on these issues, right? About when can we serve or not serve other people in our restaurants or in our businesses? Just to even have that, enter in that conversation, seems these days, you know, has just erupted in a bunch of a variety of uncivil actions and calls for violence and things like that. I mean, because what I understand is after Sarah Huckabee, after they left the restaurant, as they were asked, it wasn't like they were left alone, right? I think there were calls to follow and harass them to wherever they were headed next.
Yeah, you know? And that is part of, you know, having freedom of conscience means allowing people the freedom to disagree with you,
right?
Or even the freedom to be morally wrong to a certain extent, without being harassed about it.
Right.
You know, you can say something to somebody. You ought to say something to somebody when they're morally wrong, but crossing that line and trying to harass somebody into doing the right thing, that's more a violation of conscience than it is trying to...
Seems like the wrong means.
Yep, exactly.
Guys, that is all the time we have. I just want to toss in a couple things here. First of all, number one, you mentioned the Ten Commandments. Great, great start for forming a conscience. My second suggestion would be, pick up a Bible, go to Mark chapter 5. There's these things called the Beatitudes. That's going to tell us what we need to do in life. And I'm going to wrap it up by just saying this. We need to follow JC. And I'm not talking Jiminy Cricket. I'm talking Jesus Christ. That is all the time we have for The Catholic Cave for today. For Mark Tuttle, for Timothy O'Donnell, I'm Kent Blanford. Until next time, may God bless.
The Catholic Cave is a production of Catholic Radio Indy. Replays of this program are available in podcast form at catholicradioindy.org. Comments about this program can be addressed to kent@catholicradioindy.org or by calling 317-870-8400.
Did you miss something in this show or just want to hear it again? Podcasts of this and all our other great local programs are available 24/7 at catholicradioindy.org.